Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Katie Wang.
And joining us for the second half of the show is Janice Gardner with Wild Utah Project. Janice, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us here, and good morning to you and your listeners.
Well, we just had a conversation about, a broader raging conversation about some of the ecological issues here in the West. And Wild Utah Project kind of brings that to a local and project level in Utah. Let's start by just talking a little bit about the organization. Give us a profile of what you guys do.
Yeah, our organization, our mission is to provide science-based strategies to conserve wildlife and land. We really value our policy and management decisions surrounding wildlife and land conservation being informed by data and science. Another thing that we value is getting the community involved in gathering that information and being part of those decisions. So we have a lot of citizen scientists, or community scientists, as it's also called, projects. As your listener was just talking, or your past guest was just saying, we also recognize that a lot of our state and federal wildlife management agencies are understaffed, underfunded, and they're being asked to make some significant decisions about our wildlife without very much information. So that's where our organization is able to step in and provide some of the information.
So right now you have, and probably at any given time, you have a huge variety of programs going on. So we had talked about kind of highlighting the pollinator project. That's one that's in the forefront right now. So tell us about that.
Yeah, at any time we have, right now we've got about five projects going on, and these are generally multi-year projects. A project that was just kicked off this year is our Plants and Pollinator Project. The focus is on monarch butterflies. The reason that Wild Utah Project got involved in this project is because, unfortunately, the monarch butterfly is petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act. So since the 1980s, 1990s, the monarch butterfly populations have really plummeted across the East and West, which is very unfortunate. That's from a number of reasons: climate change, habitat loss, pesticide use, loss of their host plant milkweed. So we have partnered with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, the Hogle Zoo, and the Xeris Society to start a citizen science project to help gather some information about Utah's monarch butterflies, because we don't know very much about them.
What do we know about Utah's monarch butterflies? That's a common question.
Yeah. Well, the butterflies on west of the Rocky Mountains, they typically start their winters in California, and multiple generations sort of climb and march their way to the north, reproducing. And then as fall comes, that last sort of generation, wherever it is, knows winter's coming, and it migrates back to the same place where its ancestors' butterflies were.
That's so wild to me.
It is. Wildlife is amazing. And long-distance migrations, it's so fascinating. But we don't know a lot about the monarchs in Utah. We know we have monarchs here. We don't know if they're all over the state, if there's certain habitats that are important. We don't really know the status of milkweed plants in Utah. There's a lot of monarch butterfly lovers out there. So especially in suburban and urban areas, we get some reports of monarch butterflies in those areas. But in some of our more rural areas, we don't have a lot of information about the monarchs.
So are they just kind of taking a detour to come through Utah to go up to California? I mean, clearly we don't have the same. I mean, you think of monarch butterflies, you think of this mass migration, right, down in Mexico, just hundreds of thousands of butterflies. We certainly don't see that here.
So from where they winter, they're sort of spreading out over the landscape. So that includes creeping north in through Utah and to the north. And then it's that last generation that makes that really, really long haul back to their winter home.
Right. And then what's their role here? I mean, do we know yet what's their role here in terms of pollination, or is it just kind of a stopping point?
Yeah, monarch butterflies are one of many pollinators that we have. Their host is the milkweed plant. And pollinators across the world actually are in decline. So this is part of a larger conservation issue that Wild Utah Project is really interested in. So the monarch butterflies, we know that they're migrating through. We know that they are breeding here. Actually, just last week, we were checking out some showy milkweed plant just south of Salt Lake City, and we saw some monarch eggs on it. So right now, there's lots of action going on with our monarchs that are here.
That's great.
So do you find that people have a hard time identifying monarchs? I think there are so many butterflies like in this area that may look a little bit similar. So how do you work with the volunteers on identifying the specific species and documenting it and those kinds of things?
Yeah, so there's another butterfly called the viceroy that looks very similar to a monarch. It's orange and black and has pretty similar patterns. But once you see the two against, like compared to each other, it's actually pretty easy even for, you know, a non-expert to tell apart. So the project we have is that's in partnership with these organizations that I mentioned. There's really two parts of it. So the first part is you can download an app called Survey123. That's available for pretty much all platforms. And what you can do is while you're hiking or while you're just out and about, if you see milkweed plants or signs of monarchs, you can record those. And so how do you know what monarch eggs look like and the caterpillars is we've got lots of training materials online. So you can go to our website, which is wildutahproject.org, and do your own self-training right there on the website. And that will get you prepared for going out into the field on your own and making some observations of milkweed and the monarchs.
So you're taking pictures? I mean, is it a fairly easy
It really
app
is.
To use
yep.
In terms
so
of documenting what you see.
It's amazing how smartphones have really revolutionized data collecting in this day and age. it's really as simple as going, you know, you don't need cell phone service because most of our smartphones have GPSs in them. And so if you're on a hike or walking out and about, if you see a milkweed plant, you can record it. And then you can start looking around the milkweed plant to see if you see any of the signs of the eggs or the caterpillars or even adults.
Right. And then I assume all that gets mapped.
It does. It all gets. Yep. And so that's going to be part of a larger data set that the state is going to be using to help inform some of their management decisions around monarch butterflies, especially if this butterfly is listed.
Now, the monarch butterfly seems to be kind of like the key species in your pollinator project. Are you also working on documenting like other bees, or are monarchs a good indicator for ecosystem health for other species? Where does that tie in?
Yeah, pollinators are a priority species group for us that we've made a long-term commitment to keep working on. So this year, like I said, the monarch was our opportunity to kick this long-term program off. There's other species that are also in need. For example, the western bumblebee is one of those. So stay tuned, and in coming years, we'll probably be adding more species or just more general ways to document pollinators.
How many people do you get participating in these types of citizen science projects?
Last year, we had over 200 volunteers on, about four projects. And they supported over 3,000 hours of volunteer time. So a lot of our volunteers work on one project or even multiple projects. And what's nice about it is that our projects are they're varied enough that depending on what your schedule is or what capacity you have to volunteer, there's a project that's right for you. So, for example, the Monarch Project is great because if you just have the weekends off and you want to collect some information, but you don't really have, maybe your schedule doesn't allow you to commit to a certain time, you can sort of do that incidentally while you're doing other things. Whereas we have other projects like our Wasatch Wildlife Watch, which I know my colleague Dr. Mary Pendergrass talked about previously on this program, that takes a lot more commitment. So there's mandatory trainings, and it involves monitoring a research site throughout the summertime. So there's a lot more commitment there. So that's what's nice about our projects.
And we don't want to spend, of course, too much time on it because, as you said, we've talked about it. But the Wasatch Wildlife Watch involves using camera traps to gather data about wildlife, right?
It does, yeah. We realize we have very little information about the wildlife here in the Wasatch, including even our large mammals like elk and deer. So this is the second year of a long-term study that is in partnership with the University of Utah and a graduate student there, Austin Green. And we have over 100 volunteers managing trail cameras all the way from City Creek over to the Jordan River and down through Little Cottonwood Canyon. And we are documenting all sorts of great species, bobcats, cougars, elk, deer, moose. And that will inform some maps that we can make to identify critical habitat areas or perhaps travel corridors that are important to wildlife, so then we can better manage and protect those in the future.
And how do you come up with the projects? I mean, you have it's a pretty wide range when you look at the list of different things that you're kind of paying attention to and putting research on. Do the agencies come to you, or do you as an organization, say as scientists, say, okay, this is where we're seeing the gaps in information and what we have the resources to fill?
Yeah, we work in partnership with a lot of state agencies and federal agencies and also other nonprofits. So we hear about where the shortcomings are, where the data gaps are, and where they could use some support. So that's usually step one. Because we do value getting community scientists involved in our projects, step two is typically to see if the project, if that's a right match for doing a volunteer project. Not all projects are, and we do also do just some more traditional research projects as well. But and then from there, we work to develop project proposals and then go shop around for funding, you know, see if we can get more partners involved and then start implementing the project and sustain it for the long term.
So another project or I guess research topic you're looking at is the presence or I guess absence of the boreal toad. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, this project is it's our amphibian project. We've been studying boreal toads for this is the sixth year, and this is another project that's led by my colleague Dr. Pendergast. And boreal toads are indicators of good water quality, good habitat conditions, and they've disappeared from a lot of places across the state of Utah. So on that project, we've been working in partnership with the Hogle Zoo, the Division of Wildlife Resources, and we've been doing surveys with volunteers for boreal toads all around the state, actually, including right here in the Wasatch. This year, we had many trips, and it was kind of a different approach in previous years. We had trainings and individuals going out on their own. This year, we're doing more of group trips so we can better cover some of these ponds and toad habitats. And we've been finding some toads in places we haven't seen them in a while. So we're pretty encouraged and excited by that.
Always fun when you find like optimistic news in these projects, right. I'm sure.
Yes. And you know, that's one thing that I really value about my work at Wild Utah Project is that there's a lot of stuff going on these days. Like your previous guest was talking about, there's some heavy policy things going on with our natural resources. We provide opportunities to do on-the-ground conservation work. It feels good to me. I think that these small efforts cumulatively make a difference and really help our natural resource managers. So if you're feeling a little discouraged, as I imagine some of you might be, getting involved in one of our volunteer projects, I think, is a great way to feel like you're doing something and supporting our natural resources. So, like I said, the Pollinator Project is a great one to get on, and there's lots of activity going on with the monarchs right now. So there's information on that on our website, wildutahproject.org.
Fantastic.
We have one other project that's also, we've got a lot of partnerships on this one. It's Trout Unlimited. We're also working on a project with Swanner.
Of course.
Center. We do a lot of stream restoration projects. Our streams are degraded for a number of reasons, overgrazing, climate change, habitat loss in the riparian area. So we do some what's called low-tech restoration activities. These are hands-on projects. We've got day-long projects scheduled on our calendar right now. The first ones are going to be up at Fish Creek, which is just outside of Colville. You can go onto our website to learn how to sign up for one of those restoration days, and we'll be adding a lot more dates to the calendar throughout this fall.
I have to say that I can vouch that firsthand, you know, doing some stream restoration work in the stream is really rewarding and a lot of fun if you need something, you know, out of the office, away from the desk.
Right. Get your hands a little bit dirty. Well, yeah. I think what's interesting about what you do is the connectivity portion of it, you know, connecting these riparian areas, connecting wildlife habitats. That I think, you know, as people think about climate change and it's kind of this gloom and doom, like, oh, what can we do if, you know, things are getting degraded, making sure that there's pathways for animals to be successful to, you know, new habitats that are perhaps not as degraded or farther north, so not as hot potentially.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I love about our stream restoration project. There is a lot of low-hanging fruit. So every project we work on really does make a big difference, and it provides, you know, connectivity to other habitats, improves our water quality, quantity and supply. So they're great projects.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Janice Gardner. She's a conservation ecologist with Wild Utah Project, here talking about their many research projects and citizen science projects with opportunities for you, all of our listeners, to get involved. Janice, tell us a little bit more specifically about some of the work that you're doing on these streams, and in particular with the monitoring of them, so that you can figure out how is this stream changing over time.
Yeah, so in addition to our stream restoration project, we also do stream condition assessments as well. You know, one of the primary reasons we do this is we like to monitor the impact of our conservation actions. So before we do restoration on a stream, we will do a stream condition assessment, which is called the Rapid Stream Riparian Assessment. It's a method we've been using for a number of years. We also train volunteers to help us do that survey. So we have trainings every year so we can get volunteers out in the field collecting data on streams with us. We go ahead, we do the restoration projects, and then a year or two later we can come back, do that same stream assessment again, and see if we've improved, if we indeed have improved the conditions on the stream as, you know, as we had hoped. So we are doing these pre-restoration surveys all over the place this year. We just did one on Swanner this year. We were up in Toll Canyon Creek doing one. We also have work on East Canyon Creek as well.
Well, and I have to jump in and say that if people are interested in volunteering, you know, learning this riparian assessment, volunteering with stream restoration, I have to plug the project that we have going on Swanner Preserve later this summer. And this, of course, is a partnership with Wild Utah Project and Swanner and Trout Unlimited and some other folks. And we will be recruiting for volunteers, and we'll be looking for people to help us out with all of these different aspects. So if you're interested in helping, you can contact us at Swanner, or you can contact Wild Utah Project, and they'll loop you in as well.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to some of these projects, because they're also great opportunities for a lot of different partners to get together and work on these projects, you know, collectively. And again, I think these small projects, they really add up to make a difference.
So for these projects, just kind of from the, you know, the observational side here, sideline that I sit on, are they appropriate for younger folks? Could you bring your family? Could you bring teenage kids?
Yeah, I would say that, so basically we're working in stream, we're cutting willow limbs and basically making human-made beaver dams in the streams. And I would say for maybe kids that are 10, 11, 12 and older,
got to be willing to get wet, do some serious work.
And we are working near water, so there's always safety concerns with little kiddos around water. But yeah, it really is a great family activity. It's a fun group activity. And like you mentioned, it's a lot of fun.
Right. Well, I think it's good for
kids. Who doesn't love playing in the stream?
Yes. Exactly. Well, it's good for kids to see. I think, you know, you see beaver dams, and my children always ask, oh, what's that? You know, what's happening? Is that bad? It's flooding. But to see how science works on the ground, see what animals actually do, what their role is in the ecosystem. So if you can bring your older kids, I think it's a nice opportunity for them to see science in action and kind of the value of when they go back to school, that it's not just about sitting in the classroom. It's, you know, gaining these valuable tools that can be used for something like this.
Absolutely. And one of the really neat things is that on these restoration projects, we always have biologist staff from agencies, other nonprofits. So it's a really cool way for folks to interact with biologists, working professional biologists, and learn a lot more about the resource. So it's a cool learning opportunity as well.
Right. And see what that job's about. What does a biologist do? Here it is, right? Hanging out in streams and making a difference. It's pretty cool.
Don't let them see the data entry back in the office.
Yes. Well, there's always, you know, the dark side to everything. Right?
So we have a couple more minutes, and we've been talking a little bit about these man-made beaver dams. So describe, you know, what the benefits and the impacts of those are.
Yeah, so these low-tech restoration tools, like, for example, beaver dam analogs, which is a term folks may have heard before, but yeah, they're human-made beaver dams. Some of our streams are so degraded. There's no willows. They're incised and eroded that we would love to just have beaver come in and patch things up, but there's not even, you know, vegetation for the beavers to eat. There's not deep enough water for the beavers to hide from predators. So by first putting in these beaver dam analogs, we're able to raise the water temperature, or raise the water table, get wetlands to start functioning again on the riparian areas, and that will promote willow growth, hopefully eventually cottonwood growth, and then beavers on their own, whether they come through naturally or perhaps they are reintroduced by the state, can then keep these beaver dam analogs in repair and then hopefully continue their work throughout the stream.
And then that allows creates habitat for other animals, right? You get bird species coming back and you start seeing the ecosystem start functioning.
It does, yeah. Beavers are ecosystem engineers, and the work they do on streams not only improves the stream health, but it provides habitat for so many wildlife species.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left, and so it's time to kind of start wrapping up. So if people are, you know, interested in learning more about Wild Utah Project or meeting with you or the team, what's the best sort of entry point?
Yeah, so I would say go to our webpage at wildutahproject.org. From there, you can go to our projects page, and you can sign up for projects just if you're generally interested, or you can RSVP for specific projects and restoration days. So like I said, we've got restoration days for stream restoration on the calendar right now. They're coming up at the end of this month, the beginning of September, so I'd encourage you to check that out. Some of our projects have wrapped up for the year largely, but if you'd like to participate in them next field season, please go ahead and sign up for them, and you'll be getting information next season on how to get involved.
Fantastic. Well, that is Janice Gardner. She's a conservation ecologist with Wild Utah Project. Janice, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.